On August the 21st of 1992, federal agents would get into a gunfight on a mountaintop known as Ruby Ridge in northern Idaho. What would follow this gunfight is an 11-day standoff that left three people dead, including a federal agent. The events that transpired over those 11 days would lead to one of the messiest trials and media controversies in federal history. And at the heart of it all was a several year-long conflict between the federal government and a family tucked away in the mountains of northern Idaho, simply known as the Weavers. Hello, everybody. Today we're going to be talking about the siege, standoff, controversy, and conspiracy of the Ruby Ridge incident. Now, those of you that have been around the channel for a while or just know American history are probably already familiar with this event. Because of the teams involved and the incident itself, it shares a lot of similarities to the Waco siege of 1993, as well as other tragedies in American history like the Oklahoma City bombing. And if you are familiar with this case, then you probably know how messy it can get. For those on the side of the Weavers, the narrative is that a group of good people who never asked for any trouble were simply attacked and murdered by federal agents. While those in support of the state's actions say that a group of dangerous radicals started a needless gunfight and killed a federal agent in the course of his duties. And I believe that, as with most things, the truth is somewhere in the middle. While I've been familiar with Ruby Ridge for several years at this point, in preparation for this video, I watched a lot of interviews and read a lot of excerpts with people on either side of the conflict. And it's apparent to me that there's a lot of information that adds up and a lot of information that doesn't. So what I want to do is take you on a series of events and go through a timeline of when this all began to digging through the messy controversy of who's to blame. Because some parties in this event are certainly innocent and others are certainly guilty. So if all of that sounds interesting to you, then stick around as we talk about one of the most controversial events in American federal history. But before we do that, you want to talk about something that isn't controversial? Like how cool the new merch drop is. Thanks to the support that you all showed the hoodie and Hawaiian shirt drop, which really I can't thank you all enough for, I've partnered with Juniper again to bring you guys another limited release. For those who are a fan of the Cryptid Iceberg series or just weird things in general, the new Wendigoon Cryptid t-shirt is probably up your alley. Not only is it a really cool design with a bunch of different cryptids in front of the full moon, but the shirt is even designed with puff print. It may be hard to see on camera, but that means that things like the lettering and the trees and water around the scene are made out of a very soft raised material, which means the shirt looks better and is also super comfortable. And if that wasn't cool enough, check this out. The back of the shirt features tour dates for a bunch of different cryptids, with the date being the time they were first discovered. I love this t-shirt design, and if that wasn't enough, there's a limited release beanie as well. I wanted this design to be subtle so you could kind of pair it with anything, so it's just a black beanie, but the logo at the front of the beanie is the Conspiracy Iceberg logo, the Illuminati pyramid on top of an iceberg, and it also glows in the dark. The logo, at least, not the entire black beanie. That would be weird. Links to both of these items will be in the description. You'll be able to pre-order them for a few weeks, and then after that, they're gone forever. So if you want in on either or both of these items, head to the link in the description while you can. And most importantly, from the bottom of my heart, thank you all for the support you've continued to show me and the channel. I can't say thank you enough. It really does mean the world. So if you're interested in checking these out and helping out the channel, it really does mean the most. Link in the description, get them while you can. And you know what? If you're gonna be miserable and listen to me describing a lot of people dying and everyone being really sad, you might as well do it on a full stomach. But you know what's not depressing? Food. Fresh food. Fresh, healthy, delicious food from today's sponsor, Factor. Factor makes meeting your nutrition goals easier than ever by delivering fresh, never frozen, dietitian approved meals right to your doorstep. Factor provides delicious, easy to make meals that are as affordable as they are nutritious. One of the reasons I find myself so apt to eat an unhealthy diet is because it's just so easy to make. But now Factor is here to compete. That's because their never frozen meals can be ready in as little as 2 minutes. Not only that, but it's less expensive and way healthier, as all of the meals are made by gourmet chefs and then approved by dietitians. On top of that, Factor meals are 100% ready to heat and eat, so there's no prepping, cooking, or cleanup needed. You can also get as much or as little as you need by choosing 6 to 18 meals per week. And on top of that, you can pause or reschedule your deliveries at any time. And with over 35 different options to choose from and 55 nutrition-packed add-ons, it's never been easier to get a variety of delicious foods that are also
Good for you. Factor is now owned by HelloFresh, a company that I've worked with on podcast and absolutely love their product. And just like HelloFresh, Factor is committed to getting food to you that both you and your body can enjoy. And if you're looking to take control of your health, wallet, and palate, then there's never been a better time to get in on this offer. That's because if you head to factor75.com or click the link below and use code WENDIGOON50, you'll get 50% off your first Factor box and free wellness shots for life. That is right, two free wellness shots from three available flavors for every order while you are an active subscriber. So once again, to get half off your first Factor box and free wellness shots for life, head to factor75.com at the link in the description or use discount code WENDIGOON50 to get in on this fantastic offer today. Thank you all so much for watching the ad, and thank you so much to Factor for sponsoring this video. It really does mean the most. Hope you all check them out. Link is in the description, and we are back to the video.
We are going to go ahead and get into it, but as always, thank you for watching. Now, to understand the events of Ruby Ridge, we must first understand the Weavers. More specifically, the father of the family, Randall Weaver. Randall, or Randy Weaver, was born to a small Iowa farming family on January the 3rd, 1948. By all accounts, Randy had a pretty normal upbringing that's not atypical of a small Christian family in the American Midwest. The first crucial moment in Randy's life, at least as it attributes to Ruby Ridge, would come when Randy was 20 years old. Then in 1968, Randy dropped out of the community college he was attending in order to join the military as the war in Vietnam was at its peak. So Randy enlists and eventually finds his way into the Demolition Combat Engineers course at Fort Bragg. For the next couple years, Randy continued to receive training. However, he was never actually shipped out to Vietnam. One of the first major points that the media gets wrong about Randy Weaver is they often say that he was a Green Beret and that he was a decorated war veteran. And while yes, Randy was in the military, he never actually went to war. As a matter of fact, in October of 1971, Randy received an honorable discharge from the military. And while it's not explicitly stated why Randy decided to leave the military, from what we see later in his life, it can be imagined that he grew anti-government sentiments during his time in the military, and perhaps he simply lost faith in what he was planning to fight for. 1 month after his discharge, in November of 1971, he would marry a girl from back home named Vicky Jordanson. From there, Randy spent a little while in college before he dropped out and got a job at the John Deere manufacturing facility in Iowa. And for a while, everything was perfectly normal. Randy was a guy who did some time in the military, now he just works at a factory, all is well and good. That is until Randy and Vicky, and more specifically Vicky, became more and more religious. Now for the record, if you're new to the channel, I am a Christian, I talk about it a lot in my videos. I, of course, don't think there's anything wrong with someone becoming more religious. However, it's the particular flavor of religious that seemed to be the issue. Because Vicky began to focus on details of Old Testament prophecy, and more specifically, details of coming revelation. While they would, by definition, be Christian, they weren't so much focused on the Jesus Christ of the New Testament as they were the fire and brimstone of the Old Testament. Because of that, Vicky began to focus on details of the coming tribulation and how Christians would have to fight back against the evils of the world. Because of this, and the fact that Randy and Vicky now had three children, Sarah, Samuel, and Rachel, they decided to find a plot of land where they could fortify their family and stay away from the evils, as they saw it, of the outside world. So, in 1983, the Weaver family bought a 20-acre property in the mountains of northern Idaho, about 30 miles south of the Canadian border. They bought the 20-acre property for the price of $5,000 plus their moving van.
Hey, so this case has a lot of different ins and outs, and in the initial recording, I forgot to mention a few small facts or tidbits, so I'm periodically going to pop in here at the editing desk with some stuff I forgot to mention. The first thing being, according to Randy Weaver at least, the property they lived on wasn't actually Ruby Ridge. According to him, they were on a property called Caribou Ridge, and Ruby Ridge was the next peak over. However, once the media heard the word Ruby Ridge, I guess it just sounded, you know, sexier or whatever. So they began to call the property Ruby Ridge, and to this day, for the rest of eternity, people are going to consider that ridge Ruby Ridge.
And for a year, the family lived at peace atop Ruby Ridge, and everything seemed to be fine. For a year. because it would be in 1984 when their troubles would begin. In 1984, Randy would get into a property dispute with a neighbor who owned the adjoining property, a man named Terry Kennison. There was some kind of spat between the two where one of them argued that this certain section of land was theirs, while the opposing side said that it was actually their land. This would eventually go to trial, and in the trial, Terry Kennison lost and owed $2,100 in legal fees. Shortly after losing his trial, Terry Kennison wrote a letter to the FBI saying that Randy Weaver wanted to kill Ronald Reagan, the governor of Idaho, and the Pope. And it was from this moment that the Weavers' troubles began. On February the 12th of 1985, Randall and Vicky were brought to the local sheriff's department where they were interrogated by the sheriff, two Secret Service members, and two FBI agents. Because, you know, someone saying that you want to kill the president is typically frowned upon. Now, over the course of this interview, it became clear pretty quick that Randy wasn't actually planning to kill the president. And I don't know if you keep up with history a lot, but Randy Weaver didn't kill the president. And you know, someone who's upset because they lost a legal battle telling the FBI that you're planning to do something's a pretty good alibi. However, it was over the course of this interview that the real troubles of the Weaver family would begin. That's because during this interview, Randy was asked about an associate of his named Frank Cumnick. That's because Frank was a member of an association known as the Covenant, the Sword, and the Arm of the Lord. Now that organization is opening a whole can of worms in and of itself. For those that aren't aware, during the 1980s and 1990s, the federal government was concerned about a lot of domestic militia groups. Basically, large groups of people who would get together, amass weapons, and hold anti-government sentiments. Some of these organizations became violent and would carry out attacks against government agencies. As a matter of fact, this group, the Covenant, the Sword, and the Arm of the Lord, have a whole history of run-ins with the law that eventually culminated in a big standoff at their compound, another federal siege I'll maybe talk about one day. So while the FBI felt that the Reagan threat didn't mean anything, being associated with someone that's a part of a group the FBI is keeping an eye on certainly does. So while Randy and Vicky left that meeting with nothing concrete against them, the feds were definitely keeping an eye on them. And that would come full circle in July of 1986 when an undercover informant spotted Randy Weaver at a meeting for the Aryan Nations. And this is where all the controversy and he said, she said part of the case begins to take effect. So remember how I said there was a lot of like militia groups in the United States at this time, and some of them were violent? Well, the Aryan Nations were definitely one of those some. And while things like white supremacy made their way into a lot of these clandestine groups, the Aryan Nations, if you couldn't tell by the name, were explicitly founded on that principle. During this time, the feds had a lot of undercover agents at these Aryan Nation meetings. Reason being, they were causing a lot of noise. Just previous to all this going down, a subset of the Aryan Nations called the Order had carried out a series of destructive attacks against federal property and even murdered a Jewish talk show host. One of the departments that would do this was the ATF. ATF, as I've talked about before on the channel, or the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, regulates alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. Since groups like the Aryan Nations were moving a lot of guns, ATF agents were placed undercover to see if they could cause any arrest or disruption based on firearms charges. And it was in July of 1986 that one of these ATF informants named Kenneth Fadley, at the time going under the alias of Gus Migazzano, would meet Randy Weaver at a meeting of Aryan Nations. Now, this is where the first disparity arrives in information regarding Randy's involvement with Aryan Nations and other dangerous groups of people. From the government's point of view, Randy Weaver was a member of the Aryan Nations and helped them carry out a lot of their crimes, which included bank robberies, theft, attempted murder, etc. From the Weaver's narrative, Randy never agreed with the Aryan Nations, but occasionally, because he had accomplices that were in the Aryan Nations and needed favors from them, do odd jobs for them, etc., would begrudgingly attend meetings in order to get whatever job he needed done out of them. Now, from all the reading I've done, research on both sides, again, I think the truth is somewhere in the middle. According to everything I've read, which is both the testimony of Randy as well as the federal informant, Randy was not a member of the Aryan Nations. The Aryan Nations were very particular about who was allowed in their group. They, you know, kept logs of membership and what have you, and Randy never showed up on them. Furthermore, the federal informant said that over the course of 3 years, he saw Randy Weaver a total of 4 times. And that at these meetings, Randy would never actually enter the building or meeting itself, and would simply hang out in the parking lot, talk to some people, then go home. Furthermore, the informant believed, up until the events we're going to talk about in a second, that Randy Weaver was never involved with any crimes that were taking place because of the Aryan Nations. However, that being said, Randy Weaver held a lot of beliefs that were in line with Aryan Nation doctrine. While he's never quoted as saying anything to support the harm of another group of people, he is seen in favor supporting the importance of his own. So while many state the narrative that Randy Weaver never joined with Aryan Nations or some other fringe group because he didn't align with them, it seems more likely it's because he didn't want to be officially aligned with something that could put him on the government's radar. And while it is true, as the family stated, it seems that Randy was hard up for money. I mean, they were pretty self-sufficient up on top of Ruby Ridge and didn't need a ton of income. But for what little Randy did need, it seems he was willing to perform odd jobs with people here and there. So while that tracks that maybe he was trying to get business around these meetings, at the very least, he was still willing to break bread with them. Now, why does this distinguishment matter? Why am I even bringing this up in the first place? Because it was Randy's involvement with the organization that would shape a lot of the federal government's behaviors moving forward. I think it's also important to paint a picture of the Weavers' mindset during all this, to kind of outline what it seems their beliefs were. As mentioned earlier, it seems the Weavers took on a very Old Testament, brimstone and fire approach to the Bible. Because of this, they were very focused on principles of the law, principles of the early covenant, and principles of God's people and everyone else. This can be seen in a lot of their writings and letters that they would put out to the media and the government, as well as signage that they put around their property. Rather than the Christian idea of being a follower of God and wanting to share that light with other people and bring other people to God, the Weavers had a much more us versus them mentality. Because of that, a lot of their praxis came down to sorts of paranoia. Rather than wanting to be kind and make peace with other people, they instead decided the best course of action was to fortify themselves and keep the rest of the world out. Now, of course, this doesn't mean they were entirely removed from society. As a matter of fact, in 1988, Randy would run for sheriff of Boundary County, as well as keep up with his mail at a P.O. box and local events. But what it does mean is, as things became more intense, their mindset fed into the idea that this is what they had been planning for.
I also want to clarify, I kind of make it out to sound like the Weavers didn't know anyone and 100% kept to themselves. They did have friends, like neighbors and people who lived in the area, but it was a very closed off tight group of people. So later in this video, when I mention their family, friends and stuff like that, keep in mind they do have them. They're just very particular about who they're friends with.
In my Waco video, I spoke about one of the biggest misunderstandings the FBI had was that they could show brute force to a group of people who have spent their whole lives preparing for brute force. And we have a similar situation here. As this progresses, we're going to see that the government continues to use a hammer as their only tool against a group of people who have spent their entire lives preparing for a hammer. Also, side note, when Randy ran for sheriff, his whole platform that he was going to enforce the laws that people want to be enforced and not enforce the ones they don't want enforced. And as his little gimmick for the campaign, he would go around handing get out of jail free cards. Another reason I wanted to bring up that stuff about Randy Weaver is because I feel it's important given where the story goes from here. There's kind of this narrative regarding Ruby Ridge. And I don't think it's malicious in any way. Most people who I talk to about the story just don't know all of the details. I mean, I didn't know a lot of them before I started research for this video. But a lot of people prop up Randy Weaver as some kind of moral figure or completely clean individual who was just randomly targeted by the government for no reason. And I think it's important to point out the truth of Randy Weaver because in order to talk about the federal government's actions, which I will be very critical of here in a minute, I don't want the perception to come across that I am just making it a good versus bad debate. For full transparency, I do not like Randy Weaver. I think anyone who claims to be a Christian and then sets himself in a hole and is bitter to the outside world and looks at any other group of people as anything other than children of God is despicable, and I don't like it. So when I talk about how the feds continue to mess up as the story progresses, I am not doing so to proclaim the purity of Randy Weaver. I am doing so because I hold the federal government, the people who are paid to keep us safe, to a higher standard than some guy who lives in a mountain in Idaho. The people who protect us are supposed to be the exception, not the baseline. Especially in a situation like Ruby Ridge, where innocent children are involved in the midst of all of this. And given where this story goes in a bit, I think Randy Weaver could have been the most evil person in the world, and there's still room to criticize the government's actions. So anyway, clarification aside, after 3 years, the federal agent is invited by Randy Weaver to come to his house at Ruby Ridge. Randy, completely unaware that Fadley is an undercover agent and that his real name is Fadley, has Fadley over to his property and talks about how he's trying to build a compound to hold out against the end times. It's around this time that Hadley let Randy into his cover story. The cover story being that Hadley ran guns for Aryan Nations and whoever else needed guns. Randy's interested in this and agrees to meet Hadley to discuss it over dinner. On October the 11th of 1989, this meeting between Hadley and Randy takes place. Hadley says that the hot new item on the street is short-barreled weapons. And Randy says if it can make him some money, Randy would be happy to produce them for Hadley. A couple weeks later, on October the 24th, Randy once again meets up with Hadley and delivers him two short-barreled shotguns. Hadley gives Randy $300 for the shotguns, saying he'll give him an additional $150 along with whatever other weapons Randy could get to him in the future, with Randy stating he would be willing to produce as many as 4 or 5 guns a week. And it was with the transfer of those shotguns and that exchange of money that Randy Weaver's fate was sealed. Now, it's not illegal to sell somebody a shotgun in the United States. However, it is illegal to make a short one. And if you're a normal, well-adjusted person who has no idea what I'm talking about, then let's take a brief moment to talk about the absurdity of federal firearms laws.
I also want to say, for YouTube, all the firearms you are about to see are airsoft, or fake, or a replica, or not real. So, don't demonetize this video, because there are fake guns there. Everything I'm showing is for educational purposes. Please.
So, you want to learn about firearms laws. That's a shame. To understand why Randy Weaver was arrested and why so many people latch on to the events of Ruby Ridge, we need to understand a little thing called the NFA. In 1934, the NFA, or National Firearms Act, was passed by the federal government. The purpose of the NFA was to regulate various firearms that were being employed by gangsters of the 1920s and 30s. The NFA came as a response to things like the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. The two things that the NFA originally regulated was full auto weapons or machine guns and short-barreled rifles or shotguns. Suppressors were added to it later down the line. For our purposes today, the only one we need to focus on is the short-barreled weapon clause. The law originally said that no rifle or shotgun could have a barrel length of less than 18 inches. The thought process behind this is that since gangsters are able to enter public spaces or transport weapons so easily, the weapon must now be longer than preferred carry or hideaway length or what have you. Basically, make it harder for them to conceal. Now, while shotguns are still regulated to 18 inches, eventually they would loosen up on rifles and regulate them at 16 inches. This was done in 1960, and many say it's because of things like the M1 carbine and popular military model rifles having a 16-inch barrel length. But the current law to this day, and at the time of the Ruby Ridge incident, is 16 inches on rifles and 18 inches on shotguns. The penalty for producing or having a weapon that is under the required barrel length is a $10,000 fine and up to 10 years in prison. Now, what you're probably thinking is, did this NFA actually prevent any crime? The answer is, nope. See, the NFA was written as a means to an issue of the time. They were worried about gangsters rolling up into buildings with sawed-off barrel full-auto rifles, so they regulated those things. And sure, that would help with some arrest, because now when the police raided some stash location, they not only charged them for all of the stolen money and other crimes, but they could also charge them for possession of the guns themselves. But that worked for like a few days, and then all the criminals did was just not saw the barrels until they were about to commit the crime. Because if you're about to go on a rampage or hold up a bank, why do you care about short barrel laws? What is 10 years going to do when you're racking up multiple life sentences? So historically, the NFA has been used more so for getting people who are scraping the bottom of the barrel and do dumb stuff like, I don't know, agree to sell short-barreled shotguns to a federal informant. Now, that's all that the NFA applies to Weaver's story. Feel free to skip ahead till the background doesn't look like this and I'm not wearing the sarcastic shirt. But I think it's important to emphasize how ridiculous these laws can get, because it's one of the main reasons that the events of Ruby Ridge are viewed in the way they often are. So you may be asking yourself, that's cool, so the NFA was made in the 1930s to kind of solve issues with gangsters and stuff like that. How does the NFA work with modern technology? You know, it's been like 100 years, weapons have developed a lot. How has the NFA moved to accommodate those changes? And the answer is, it hasn't. And you may be thinking, oh, okay, so they don't enforce it anymore, right? And the answer is, yep. Let's look at an example of this. So back in the 30s, most modern rifle platforms look something like this. You had a wood stock weapon and a very large action that shot a rifle round, right? It was either that or some kind of handgun. But now in the modern age, technology has changed a lot. And a lot of weapons platforms have gone from looking like that to looking something like this. The mechanism of a modern weapon is completely different compared to what it was 100 years ago. A lot of innovation has happened, but sadly, the law hasn't kept up with it. So the whole point of the NFA originally was so that people wouldn't be able to conceal weapons, right? Of course, the caveat to that is the handgun. Handguns are incredibly small and concealable compared to something like a rifle. Which, fun fact, the original versions of the NFA included pistols along with the machine guns and short-barreled weapons before it was removed, given that so many people have them and there would be an uproar over regulating them. So let's say I was to take a rifle like this, and say I was to cut the barrel about right here, that would land me in jail for 10 years. Or at least, you know, up to 10 years. Now what if we take another weapon that uses the exact same action, has the exact same caliber, and a lot of similar features like this. These two, for those who aren't super familiar with Kalashnikov platforms, these two are effectively the same gun. There's differences, of course, for the nerds out there, things like, you know, the gas block, specific platform, blah, 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 but these are both AKs. But if you'll notice, this one has a lot shorter barrel than this one. Now, a second ago, I said, if I cut this AK's barrel down, that puts me in jail for 10 years, so how is this one fine? Because legally, this one is a pistol. According to modern law, these two things are the exact same. So if I was to take this stock and put it over on this one, guess what I get? That's right, 10 years. Because according to the NFA, by putting a stock on this pistol, I have now manufactured an illegal short-barreled rifle. However, it doesn't stop there. It is also qualified as an illegal short-barreled rifle if the overall length of the weapon is less than 26 inches. So you can have a legal barrel length and do everything in your power to follow the law, but oh look, your buttstock was an inch too short. Guess that's 10 years. Sorry. I have seen ATF agents pull out measuring tapes on people to see if they're going to jail or not. People who try to follow the law and even the absurdity of laws like this are often regulated and checked to see if they're now a felon. That's not even getting into the fact that the ATF arbitrarily makes different decisions. They'll sell something and say it's totally legal for a decade before saying, actually, that's illegal, and if you don't turn it in right now, that's jail for you.
And that's not even the entire puzzle when it comes to this stuff. Like, for example, if you take a pistol like this and say I was to put a foregrip on it so I can hold the gun like this, that is also a felony. That short AK I was pointing at earlier, if I decide to put a foregrip on it, jail. Also, if I take a gun like this, and remember, the whole point of the NFA, theoretically at least, is to make the gun less concealable. So if I take a pistol like this and I put a stock on it, which makes the gun much less concealable, it more than doubles the length of it. If I put a stock on this, that's also gel, because I have now manufactured a short barrel rifle. And here's the worst part about all of this, right? So let's go along with the ATF for a second and pretend that having a short-barreled weapon just fills you with some kind of need to hurt people, right? Okay. If it actually was a law to protect people, then why can you pay $200 and just get by? That is right. If you pay a $200 tax stamp to the ATF, you can get approved to make any one weapon have a suppressor, have a short barrel, what have you. And yeah, like I said earlier, the reason this was originally done is so that they could catch people on charges theoretically before a crime's committed, even though it doesn't work in practice like that. But why is something that can be circumvented for $200 such a harsh penalty? Why does the $200 get you out of 10 years in prison instead of something like a fine? If this was just a weird law in the books that wasn't enforced and no one's life was ruined because of it, who cares, right? But lives are ruined over this time and time again. So yeah, in short, repeal the NFA.
And SBR and SBS laws are just a small piece of the ridiculous puzzle. There are laws requiring you to have American-made components inside of foreign imported guns, or otherwise it's contraband. There are laws regulating not machine guns, but guns whose mechanism makes it likely if you wanted to break the law, it would be kind of easy to make it a machine gun. There's regulations against those. It got so bad a couple years ago that arm braces, things that you could put on pistols in order to effectively make them stocks, the ATF said they were fine, and then they said that they weren't fine, and then they said that they were fine, just don't touch them to your shoulder, and then they said they weren't fine again. Well, of course, firearms regulations like this aren't as important or as devastating as things we're going to talk about the ATF and Marshals doing to the Weaver family here in a bit. It is merely a foot in the door, but that foot in the door can lead to a lot of tragedy. Now, the reason I bring all of that up isn't just to discuss the ridiculousness of these laws, although that is part of it. It's because the breaking of these laws is what led to everything that would happen afterwards, at least officially. The other reason I want to mention it is, again, the absurdity of these laws is what leads so many people to be sympathetic of Randy Weaver. Anyone who works with firearms has to put up with things like that constantly. So to look at Randy's position and see someone who suffered as much as he did over the same laws, of course it's easy to feel sympathy for him. At least when you focus on Randy the victim and not everything that led up to that victimhood. Now, in reality, was the weapons charge really a way to get a guy just because he sawed off a shotgun barrel? Or was it a way to get someone who was tied to groups like the Aryan Nations and willing to manufacture weapons for them? Kind of like getting Al Capone on tax evasion. While the latter is more than likely true, it's hard to tell considering the government has shown in the past that they will do equal and further dramatic actions over trivial laws. For a lot of people, especially those who come into this case just looking at the end result, it's hard to not perceive Randy as a hopeless victim considering how much the government dressed like an attacker. There's a reason that this story has the reputation it does. So on October the 24th of 1989, Randy delivers the two sawn-off shotguns to the federal informant. The informant turns that into the ATF, and the ATF begins to draft charges. Shortly after Fadley makes his report to the ATF, another informant by the name of Rico Valentino informs Randy that Fadley's an undercover agent. I have no idea what kind of internal politics were going on to allow a situation like that to happen, but it did, and Randy confronted Fadley, yelling at him, saying that he knows he's a cop. Fadley then left and never made contact with Weaver again. The ATF spends several months drafting their profile of Randy. And it's here that they begin to smudge the facts a bit. In the ATF reports of Randy, they mention that he is a person of interest in various bank robbings and other crimes committed by Aryan Nations and other militia groups in the region. Even though there was no evidence of this, and the informant never indicated that there was any proof Randy was involved in those crimes, the ATF began to add those details to the report in order to embellish the narrative. Because the higher risk Randy seems to be, the more resources can be exhausted in order to arrest him. However, because of the whole incident with Fadley, the ATF no longer have an informant. So, given the fact that Randy has no criminal history, has theoretically worked with law enforcement before considering he was running for sheriff, and has a military background, the feds decide to see if Randy will become their snitch. On June the 12th of 1990, federal agents came to Randy Weaver asking him to be their informant, and Randy replied by telling them where they can shove that offer. Not only that, but immediately after being asked, Randy sent letters to various people that he had contacts with in Aryan Nations and other groups, letting them know that the feds are trying to get an informant. This further angered the ATF because even if he wasn't doing it out of a love for the Aryan Nations and was more so doing it out of a hatred for the government, he's still doing a lot to help the Aryan Nations along. So in December of 1990, over a year since the actual crime was committed, charges were drafted accusing Randy of allegedly selling two short-barreled shotguns to an undercover informant. The ATF was afraid of approaching Randy at his house to arrest him. So instead, they pose as a group of motorists whose car had broken down at the base of Ruby Ridge. Randy and Vicky drive down to help the group of people out, and as soon as Randy leans over the hood, they pull their weapons and arrest both Randy and Vicky. As he was being arrested, Randy said, "Haha, good trick, you won't get me with that one again." So on January the 17th of 1991, Randy Weaver is arrested and charged. Because the crimes he was being charged with were non-violent and he didn't seem to be a flight risk, he was released on bail with the trial date set for February the 19th of 1991. And here we get another disparity in the events of Ruby Ridge. Randy met with his probation officer and lawyer one time each. Randy was fed up with any kind of bureaucrat at this point and didn't want to talk to him, so he just told them to send him a letter when they needed to speak to him. Shortly after the court date was set, the date was moved from February the 19th to February the 20th to allow more travel time for people attending the trial, given that it was shortly after a federal holiday. So, okay, the date gets pushed back one day. No big deal. Well, it wouldn't have been a big deal had Randy's probation officer not sent him a letter saying that the court date was not moved by one day, but instead by 1 month and one day. The letter from the probation officer said that the court date had been moved to March the 20th. More letters were sent to Randy correcting the date after this mistake was discovered, but it seems that Randy didn't check his P.O. box up until after the date of February the 20th. When February the 20th passes and Randy didn't appear at the court date that he didn't know he was supposed to be at, Randy was then charged with failure to appear in court. Randy's defense attorney pleaded with the judge that if Randy shows up by March the 20th, that the failure to appear in court will be dropped. But the judge isn't having it, and on March the 14th, he is officially charged and now considered a fugitive from justice. This does seem a bit extreme from the judge's point of view, right? An individual was given the wrong date, so when he doesn't show up on the correct date that you didn't tell him about, you charge him with failure to appear.
Now, I will say it can be argued that the responsibility of Weaver falls on his legal team. Again, I feel the judge should have had some level of leniency because it was Weaver's defense that messed up, not Weaver. But it also seems that Weaver's defense messed up a lot. Like, for example, at one point, Weaver's lawyer told him if he lost the trial, they would lose their home and property. And that just flat out wasn't true.
The one piece of, I guess, credit you could give the judge for his reasoning to go ahead and charge Randy anyway is there were some contributing factors implying that Randy never planned to appear in court in the first place. For example, after his initial arrest, he just quit coming off the mountain. And any level of paranoia he had before was cranked up to a million when a guy he trusted turned out to be a federal informant, and then he was arrested by three people parked on the side of the road that he was going to help. And also, in addition to that, so Vicky Weaver, who was also arrested along with Randy on January the 17th, was slightly perturbed by the federal government, if you could imagine, after getting arrested and her husband being charged. So, in between the time of their arrest and Randy's court date. She sent a couple of letters to the U.S. Attorney's Office for Idaho, but the letters were addressed to the entirety of the United States government. And in those letters, for one, she opens by addressing it to the, quote, servants of the Queen of Babylon. And some excerpts from those letters include, "We, the Weaver family, have been shown by our Savior and King, Yahshua, the Messiah of Saxon Israel, that we are to stay separated on this mountain and not leave. We will obey our lawgiver and king. Whether we live or whether we die, we will not obey your lawless government." Because of that last line, especially, a lot of people in government believe that Randy never planned to appear in court in the first place. And to further increase the distrust of the Weaver family, another line from that same letter reads, "A long-forgotten wind is starting to blow. Do you hear the approaching thunder? It is that of the awakened Saxon. War is upon the land. The tyrant's blood will flow." Now, what she probably meant by that last part, she's like invoking a lot of biblical imagery or whatnot. But because, again, as we talked about earlier, very Old Testament, very, you know, doomsday, brimstone, what have you. What she's doing there is talking about, like, when God comes back, when the rapture happens, they're going to get what's coming to them. But that's not how the government read it. The government read, "The tyrant's blood will flow," and effectively took that to mean intent. Now, regardless of if you see Vicky's letters as either intent to not show up to court and intent to hurt federal agents, or you see it as the 1991 equivalent of your drunk aunt on Facebook, I think it's safe to say charging Randy with failure to appear in court when he was not given the correct court date is ridiculous outright. Simply because that's not how laws work. If someone says, "I'm not going to appear in court," we don't charge them with failure to appear in court until they actually don't appear in court. And yes, technically, Randy didn't because he didn't show up on February the 20th, but he was never told February the 20th. He was told March the 20th. Everything I'm talking about would get heavily scrutinized and ran over 1,000 times in the court trials to follow. So anyway, Randy's attorney begins to write letters to him explaining the situation and telling him that Randy needs to come down to make peace with local law enforcement. At this point, Randy is full bore convinced that there is some kind of conspiracy against him, because he gets arrested by undercover cops, and then he's given a court date. And then they tell him, actually, he doesn't have to show up on that day. He can show up at this day instead. And then he's told, because you didn't show up on that original day, you're going to jail. On March the 11th, Randy's attorney gets two neighbors of the Weavers, who are friends with the Weavers, to go up the mountain and ask Randy what he wants to do. Randy sends them back with a letter giving out his list of demands for him to come back down the mountain. Things in this list include, he wants his pistol back that was taken from him when he was arrested by the undercover agents. He wants the charge regarding failure to appear to be dropped, and he wants the judge to apologize to him for at one point calling him paranoid. Now, while this was originally the ATF's case because it involved the manufacturing of short-barreled shotguns, Randy is now a fugitive from justice, so the ATF passes the case off to the United States Marshals. When the ATF passes off the case to the Marshals, the report or psychological evaluation or what have you of Randy Weaver is pretty dumb. Not only do they include things I mentioned earlier, like they think he has, you know, connections to a lot of bank robberies or other crimes that have occurred, but they just get stuff wrong. Like at several points in the description of Randy, it refers to him as Mr. Randall, confusing his last name to be Randall. So the marshals enter the scenario thinking they're dealing with a combatant who's ready to kill at a moment's notice. To give you an idea for how long things take in government as well, when the ATF passed the case over to the marshals, it took an entire year before the marshals actually did anything. They spent a year in technicalities and planning and stuff like that. And during that entire time, Randy maybe occasionally came down from the mountain, but for the most part just lived up there with a warrant for his arrest. The first thing the marshals tried was on March the 4th of 1992, when two marshals simply walked up to the property and told Weaver there was a warrant for his arrest. Weaver, who had a rifle over his back, told the two men that they were trespassing on private property and to get lost. And the men just drove off the property without incident. After this, the Marshals began something that they called Operation Northern Exposure. This was a mass surveillance campaign on the Weaver household. The Marshals planted cameras and microphones all over properties in and around the Weaver residence. They would do this by quite literally sneaking in camouflage at night, setting up cameras, and then leaving before being spotted. A lot of the images and videos you see of the Weavers, both just standing outside of their house, or playing, or running from gunfire, or what have you, were taken with these surveillance cameras. This observation would continue for 4 months, with the Marshals not only checking in on the camera's feed every day, but occasionally performing missions onto the Weavers' property to get more information about the household. And it's from here that a lot of aspects of the Weavers' lives were made known to investigators. At this time, the Weavers' oldest daughter, Sarah, was 16, their son, Samuel, was 14, their daughter, Rachel, was 10, and they just had a baby 10 months earlier named Elisheba, a young girl. The Weavers had a lot of animals, from chickens to horses, and the daughters would often ride the horses while Randy and his son Samuel would play together or shoot guns around the house. Vicky, who was still nursing the 10-month-old child, would normally stay with the children while Randy performed most of the work around the house. It seemed that they were entirely self-sufficient. They grew their own crops, they had a well on the property that allowed for clean water. The kids were homeschooled, as you could imagine, so day in and day out, they just went about their activities and chores amongst each other. Randy had a particular tinge of paranoia about him. Not only did he travel everywhere with a rifle over his back, but anytime a vehicle would get too close to the bottom of a hill, Randy would freak out and take a defensive position behind a rock or a tree until the noise went away. He was constantly paranoid that someone was watching him, and as it turned out, they were. This paranoia was fueled further on May the 5th when one of the Weaver family members discovered one of the hidden cameras. From here, Weaver became much more tactical in all of his planning. While it was regular for when any of the Weaver family members left the perimeter of the house, they would always bring a gun with them for fear of a bear or mountain lion, the demeanor of the house noticeably shifted. Less time was spent outside than need be, and again, Randy seemed to be much more paranoid. Or I guess paranoid isn't the right word if they're actually coming to get you. Much more defensive, we'll say. It was also around this time that a friend of Randy's named Kevin Harris began to stay at Ruby Ridge with him. Kevin Harris was a younger guy, in his mid-20s at the time all of this went down. Harris also had no affiliations with the Aryan Nations or any other group of radicals. Instead, he was just a friend of Randy's. Years back, when Harris was a teenager, he stayed with Randy and Vicky for a while. So seemingly, because Randy was paranoid as to who he could trust, he invited an old friend to help him keep watch of the house. Anytime there was a noise or something was amiss around the house, Harris and Randy could be seen stepping out on the porch with rifles over their shoulder, looking for what was the matter. And for months, this was the routine. The seven people within the house maintained their shifts, I guess except the baby, but the six other people maintained their shifts, going about their chores, and keeping a watchful eye for anyone who may approach. Later testimonials from the family would say that they were aware of the danger Randy was in, you know, being a fugitive from justice and all, but they figured no one would hurt them or no real danger would befall if they just stayed on the mountaintop. That if society doesn't want them to participate in it, they'll simply remove themselves from society. And seemingly they were content on maintaining that position for the rest of their lives. That is, until the events of August the 21st. Because if you don't know anything else about the Ruby Ridge incident, you know about the events of August the 21st and August the 22nd, 1992. Now, the events of August the 21st are heavily debated and complicated, so I thought it would be easier to make a stupid little map. See, I got like a river over here, and then trees over there. I guess the trees don't have like a trunks, so they're more of like bushes, but because this is an aerial view looking down, you wouldn't see the trunks. So it's really a more accurate tree if you think about it. Anyway, I do want to emphasize that this is in no way accurate and can't even be qualified as a guess. This is just a diagram to show you particular moments when important things happened. I have no idea if this is where the trails go. They could go that way. They could go that way. I know people walked in these areas relative to each other, so I made up a direction they might have walked. This is more of a vision, really. But imagine this as an aerial view with the Weaver cabin in the middle, the slope down to the roadway and getting off of Ruby Ridge is down here, and this area behind the cabin is elevated above it, higher ridge lines behind the cabin itself. So the U.S. Marshals were so cautious and complicated about the way they were going to arrest Randy that they had theorized maybe they could purchase a piece of property somewhere around here and then have two marshals undercover as a husband and wife move into the area to get close to Randy and then eventually arrest him. Apparently that plan had been tentatively approved, so some records say that the mission on August the 21st was to do reconnaissance for that, while others say it was just a standard part of their operation. As mentioned, they would go onto the Weaver property, set up surveillance cameras, do recon, and then ditch. It should also be noted that they weren't doing these reconnaissance missions in police uniforms or anything to identify themselves as cops. Instead, they were doing it in full camouflage with rifles and night vision goggles. That detail will be important when we get to the nuance of the events. Also, one of the reasons they were going in so armed to the teeth, other than, you know, what they saw in the surveillance cameras, is on April the 18th, one day after they set up their cameras, someone reported to someone else at the Marshal Service that Randy was shooting at helicopters. More specifically, that he was shooting at one of Geraldo Rivera's helicopters. No one has ever found the source of this information. The Rivera team never reported it. Randy denies it. So who knows where that came from? But these guys were afraid if they were spotted at all that they would be like a helicopter and be shot at. At 4:30 a.m. on Friday, August the 21st, six U.S. Marshals made entry onto the Weaver property. For the sake of this diagram, we'll say they entered here. The six men split into two teams. One team takes off an overwatch position above the Weaver cabin, and their other team, the three men who are their reconnaissance element, continues operations on the lower altitude side of the cabin itself. This goes on for a couple hours in the early morning before the recce element links up with their OP element. It seems that here the six men share information with each other before they begin to fall back from the property. With the reconnaissance team continuing on their swing over to the right side of the cabin, at least right side in this diagram, and the overwatch position goes back the way they came. Now, I don't know whose idea this next thing I'm about to say was. What's wild is everything I've said so far, pretty uncontested on both sides. And for some reason, this next part is also uncontested, although the Fed should really reconsider. One of the agents in the reconnaissance element decided to throw rocks at the cabin to test the reaction of the Weaver's dog. The Weavers had this really big lab mix dog whose name was Stryker. So the recce team wanted to see if Stryker would react to throwing rocks at the house. I don't know who that benefits, what that does. It's one of the dumbest things I've ever heard. Surprisingly enough, it's not the dumbest thing in this story. That will come later. But it's like, it's a close second. So from about 200 yards away from the cabin, they begin throwing rocks at the cabin itself. Now, here's our first divergence. The marshals would later say that the reason Stryker became alerted to the reconnaissance team is that Stryker was already making his way outside as they heard a vehicle approaching. Along with Stryker came the three men in the cabin, or two men and young boy, Samuel Weaver. However, what everyone else says, and what I think is much more likely, is that when testing if dogs react to you throwing rocks at them, the answer is yes. Stryker begins to take off towards the team of agents. The fact that Stryker ran that direction further proves the point that he probably wasn't hearing the car, he was hearing the people throwing rocks at him. The reconnaissance element, afraid of being spotted, even though their behavior would indicate otherwise, continue to make their way back down towards the lower altitude end of the cabin, with Stryker hot on their trail. Again, the three people who are now outside of the cabin with Stryker are Randy, his son Samuel, and Harris. They are none the wiser to federal agents being this close to them. When they hear Stryker begin to bark and chase something, they assume it's some kind of animal. So the men take their rifles and run outside and hope that Stryker has caught some kind of deer or game animal because they had just ran out of meat in the cabin. That's another thing of note that I'll probably forget to mention as I continue talking about this. Over the course of the siege, the entire Weaver family had almost nothing to eat. Randy tells Samuel and Harris to chase after Stryker while Randy follows the trail. He would later make comments that he didn't want to chase after Stryker directly because there wasn't a trail there, or it was a rough trail and he was getting too old for that. So Sam and Harris begin to follow in the direction that Stryker is running. As you can probably think looking at this diagram, that's a bad sign. Randy begins to make his way down the more established trail, heading to a point that he thinks Stryker will wind up at. Again, I'm making up all these trails. Maybe like these two intersect at some point, so Randy's heading down there. I don't know. What happens instead is Randy runs into the three people in the observation team that are also making their way down the mountain. So at some point, these two cross paths. So Randy is jogging down the hill when all of a sudden, someone holding a rifle and dressed in full camouflage stands up, points a gun at him, and says, "Freeze, Randy." Randy immediately recognizes this as a federal agent. Randy does not fire upon the federal agent or attempt to get his gun off of his shoulder. Either that be because he didn't think he would win the draw, or he didn't want to kill him. I'll let you decide. But what Randy does do is say, "F you," and then begin sprinting back up the hill. As this is happening, the recce team, being chased by Stryker, makes their way down to a junction at the bottom of the hill known as the Y. It was called this because it was a literal Y in the trail, and in the trials that would follow, the incident at the Y was a large point of contention. Now, we know that Stryker, Sam, Harris, and the three men in the reconnaissance team all made it to the Y, and from there is where it gets messy. The U.S. Marshals would claim for over a year that Sam and Harris were the instigators in what was about to happen, and that everything they did was in accordance with standard procedure. However, the series of events that I'm going to tell is the series of events that was eventually determined to be most likely in the trials that followed. Because the Fed side of this changed faces a lot and kept coming out to different conclusions, different series of events, whereas the Weaver side of it stayed pretty consistent and also made the most sense with evidence that was found at the trail. So going off of that narrative, and this is the narrative that a jury would eventually agree to, the reconnaissance team attempted to hide in the roadside along the Y. Stryker, still seeing the reconnaissance team, makes a beeline directly for them, again with Sam and Harris right behind him. It seems that what most likely happened is, in order to not be seen, I guess, one of the federal agents shot Stryker. Again, insert meme about feds shooting dogs. Now, this is the big point of contention in all of this that shapes a lot of what happened moving forward. The federal agents never identified themselves as federal agents. Sure, it seems that Randy made the call when he ran into them, but these two over here probably aren't thinking about that. They're thinking about what animal they're going to run into, then all of a sudden there's a gunshot and the dog is dead. Because the federal agents never identified themselves, all that these two saw was a guy in camo shoot their dog. Randy's testimony would later attest to this, as he said when he turned to sprint, he heard a gunshot and then Stryker yelp. This seems to be, although not explicitly said, but it seems to be the reason that the Overwatch team didn't try to chase Weaver back up the trail. Now, it could also be because they were afraid he was gonna, you know, run up there, then turn around and shoot him or what have you. But I believe after hearing the gunshot, they ran over here to reinforce their reconnaissance team. As soon as Stryker was shot, 14-year-old Samuel Weaver saw the man who shot his dog and said, "You shot my dog, you son of a bitch," as he raised his rifle and fired three rounds, according to most reports, at the man who did it. A federal agent raised his gun in return. By forensic reports, it was most likely William Deegan, raised his gun and fired, shooting Sam in the arm. As soon as Sam is hit, he turns his back away from the federal agents and begins to run backwards to where Harris was. Sam had got a little bit in front of Harris, so Sam is around here and Harris is more back here. As soon as Harris sees Sam get shot, he raises his rifle and shoots at the guy who just shot Sam. That round fired from Harris's gun went into the chest of U.S. Marshal William Deegan, and Deegan fell to the ground dead. The first death at Ruby Ridge, and sadly, not the last. The three agents began returning fire, and in the course of this, someone shot the retreating Samuel Weaver in the back. And with that, 14-year-old Samuel Weaver fell dead at the Y, 500 yards away from his home. Now, I'm not entirely sure what the distance of this engagement was. The way it's described, this makes it look like they're 10 feet from each other. Realistically, I think they were more like maybe 50 yards from each other, something like that. Definitely, you know, close enough for gunfighting distance, but far enough that the two surviving agents have a chance to hunker down and not immediately be in fear of being shot. This is further supported because Harris only fires a couple more rounds before he checks Sam's body, sees that Sam is dead, and books it back towards the cabin. If you'll remember, I mentioned earlier, pretty much every member of the Weaver family took a gun with them when they left the home. One of the reasons they did this, other than animals, is they had a code between them that if anyone was ever lost, they can fire a gun in the air and other people will know to come that direction. When Randy had ran into the federal agents down here, he ran back towards the cabin and began yelling, "Ambush!" After Randy heard the gunshots at the Y, he began firing his shotgun into the air in order to signal back to Harris and Sam where to run in case they get turned around. So eventually, both Harris and Randy make their way back to the cabin. And as soon as they get there, Harris releases the news that Sam's been killed. The reaction by the family is as can be expected. Vicky screaming, crying, Randy desolate. The girls not knowing what to do. Even hearing some of them talk about it to this day, it's still overwhelming to them that their brother died in such a horrific manner. Regardless of how you feel about Weaver or the feds or anyone involved in this story, I think we can all agree that the real tragedy of it all falls on the kids. This all occurred around 10:30 a.m. Shortly after this, it seems that all six or five now remaining men of the Marshall's team link up. Two of them head to a local neighbor's house and call not only the Marshall's department, but the local police in order to request assistance. Now, here's an important detail about everything involving the federal agents. They told the police, as well as eventually the FBI and their home office, that one of their agents had been killed, but never said anything about one of the Weavers being killed. As a matter of fact, they would go on to state several times in trials after this that they didn't know Sammy Weaver had been killed. Now that is possible, gunfights can be hectic, but until the events we're going to talk about later, that option was never even considered. The marshals also did not mention the fact, again until later in trial, that they were chased by the dog, took up positions, and began fighting back. The narrative was instead that the marshals were doing their recon and were attacked by the Weavers, resulting in the death of an agent. They also used language to imply that the gunfight was still going on and they were still being held down, which would imply there was a lot more people and a lot more manpower on the Weaver side than were actually at the cabin. If you're being held down for over an hour, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of rounds with shell casings expelled all over the ground and trees in the area torn to shreds. The details of what actually happened at the Y would come up later in the story, but we'll get to that. The call to 911 is made around 11:20 a.m. Because of the level of complexity, considering who all is involved, how many channels it had to go through, the local police wouldn't show up to assist the marshals until 8:30 p.m. Between the time of the call and the marshals showing up, Vicky Weaver decides in the cabin that she's going to go get her boy's body. So, as dangerous as it is, considering the marshals were right there shooting at them a minute ago, perhaps the Weavers consider that that was during a gunfight, and if they simply walk out, they won't be shot at. So, Randy and Vicky make their way back to the Y, where they recovered their son's body. Knowing that they're still under surveillance and likely won't be able to bury him right now, They place him in a small shed out behind their cabin. As the family continues to mourn the loss, local police show up, get the body of Deegan out of there, and return back to the base at the bottom of Ruby Ridge around 1 a.m. Now, again, the series of events that I just described are the way that it would come out at the end of all of this. But the narrative at this time is that marshals were checking out the property, one of them got gunned down, and the Weavers are thirsty for blood. It's because of that that the FBI took such extreme measures that we're going to talk about in just a second. Following this, the siege at Ruby Ridge exploded. Now, it wasn't just a guy who had a warrant for his arrest and wouldn't leave his house. Now, it was a group of people who killed a federal agent. Immediately, neighbors were evacuated from their homes, and all roads in and out of the area were shut down. Anytime a federal agent is killed, it immediately becomes the FBI's case. So now, for the second time in this story, one government agency passes it off to another when the U.S. Marshals pass the case to the FBI. The narrative that was given to the FBI was that a group of dangerous militant members knowingly fired on and killed a federal agent, and that non-combatants within the house, in other words, Vicky and the children, could be hostages held captive by Weaver and Harris, and that the marshals don't know how many people may be in the cabin at this time. Because of this, the FBI's response was extremely aggressive. For one, the FBI sent in the Hostage Rescue Team, or HRT, a group trained and usually tasked with saving hostages from active shooter scenarios. The HRT arrive at the mobile base at the bottom of Ruby Ridge at 4:45 a.m. in the early morning hours of Saturday, August 22nd. FBI agent Gene Glenn, who oversaw the operation, arrived a few hours earlier and began setting up checkpoints and different positions for FBI team members. The governor of Idaho declared the situation a state of emergency, which allowed the FBI and local law enforcement to employ things from the Idaho National Guard. What this meant is that local agents now began to employ things like helicopters and armored personnel carriers to the base of Ruby Ridge. Due to the information the FBI was given, that the individuals in the cabin may take the rest of the family as hostages, and that they're knowingly just trying to kill as many federal agents as they can, the FBI employed a set of very controversial rules of engagement. Now, for those that don't know, rules of engagement is effectively the rules an officer or soldier or what have you have to follow in order to engage the enemy. What this typically looks like, for example, United States police officers, is a police officer is not allowed to use lethal force unless they believe their life or the life of someone else is in immediate danger. So if you go up and start talking to a guy and you see a gun on his hip, you can't just pull your gun and shoot him, but say that guy gets mad and then pulls the gun and starts to point it at someone, then you can probably shoot him. You only take the life of another individual in the moments that would save another life. Now, of course, these rules in, say, the military or active war zones are much different. In cases where it's already understood that enemy forces are hostile, it could be something like if you see someone with a gun, not necessarily pointing it at anyone. In extreme cases, it could be, you know, military-aged males or something like that could qualify for your ROE. But on American soil, we typically like to keep the idea that the police won't kill someone unless they're actively about to kill someone else. After a lot of debate and confirming their rules of engagement with the home base back in Washington, at 2:30 p.m., the following rules of engagement were given to HRT members. A. If any adult male in the compound is observed with a weapon prior to the surrender announcement, deadly force can and should be employed, if the shot can be taken without endangering any children. B. If any adult in the compound is observed with a weapon after the surrender announcement is made and is not attempting to surrender, deadly force can and should be employed to neutralize the individual. C. If compromised by any animal, dog, that animal should be eliminated. And D. Any subjects other than Randall Weaver, Vicky Weaver, Kevin Harris presenting threats of death or grievous bodily harm, the FBI rules of deadly force are in effect. Deadly force can be utilized to prevent the death or grievous bodily injury of oneself or that of another. It is that first one, and yeah, the thing that, like, if a dog barks at you, you can shoot it. But insert ATF shooting dog meme here. But it's the first one that gained so much controversy in the trials that would follow. Anyone that just has a gun and prior to a surrender announcement. It was known on surveillance, and especially after what just happened, the guys are going to be walking around holding rifles or having a rifle slung over their arm. Without identifying yourself or telling them to freeze or stop or give up or anything, you just kill them. And while rules like that may be justified if there's someone inside holding a gun to the kids' heads, out of every bit of information that the feds have at this point, that is an absurd conclusion to jump to. Even not considering the fact that the agents shot first and never identified themselves. Several FBI agents would later testify that they thought the ROE was overkill and shouldn't have been employed, again, against a guy who missed a court date. But now an agent was dead, and the feds wanted someone to pay for it. Meanwhile, inside of the cabin, the family was desolate. After setting Sam in the shed, according to Sarah Weaver, the family just kind of sat around in silence. The three adults discussed if they should walk out and surrender, but they were all afraid because the feds shot first without giving any clarity as to what they were doing there or telling them to stop, be arrested, what have you. Or they did with Randy, at least not in Sam's case. They all figured that after Harris shot a marshal, they were probably just going to kill him on sight. So the family sat around for a while. They didn't know what to do. Sarah remarks that Vicky, at one point, it had began to rain a little bit, and Vicky said that she should put out some buckets of water to collect rainfall because they probably won't be able to go down to the well while this is going on. Kind of just in a state of shock, considering, you know, she just lost her boy. While this was happening, the HRT began to take up positions on the ridges around the cabin. One of the snipers who took position was an agent named Lon Horiuchi. After being in position for only a couple hours, Randy and Harris, with rifles slung over their arm, make their way out to the backyard. According to the Weavers, Randy had said that he wants to go check on Sam and make sure no animals or insects got to him over the night. Randy walks out to the shed, turns his back towards the ridge that he doesn't know Horiuchi is on, and as he is facing the cabin, he reaches up to unlatch the door. As soon as he does, a shot rings out. Horiuchi was aiming for Randy's spine, but given that he moved a bit at the last moment, the shot hit Randy in the shoulder. Randy collapsed, and Sarah, the oldest daughter, sprinted outside to help her dad. Sarah would later remark that she figured a sniper wouldn't shoot a young girl, so she stood in between Randy and where she thought the shot came from. Randy begins to yell that he's been hit, and Sarah and Harris help him stand up, and the three of them begin running back to the cabin. The back door of the Weaver cabin had a bungee cord attached to the top of it, so that way the door would always shut, and, you know, no one could leave the door open and let all the cooler hot air out. So, Vicky Weaver, while holding their 10-month-old child, was standing just behind the door, holding it open, so that the three of them could run back inside. As this is happening, Lon Horiuchi rechambers another round and tries to get a shot on Harris, who is running at the back of the group. So the three of them are running in, and Horiuchi points his rifle a little bit in front of Harris to try to lead the shot. Horiuchi fires. The shot goes through the air. It hits Harris in the side. The bullet continues through Harris, goes through the window of the back door, and hits Vicky Weaver in the head. At 5:58 p.m., Vicky Weaver was killed instantly. According to Sarah, as soon as the three of them got inside, they all jumped for the ground, and it was at the same moment the shot rang out, so Vicky fell to the ground as well. And then the three others began to stand up and assess themselves, except for Vicky. Randy, seeing Vicky lying on the ground, he hears the muffled cries of their baby, which was underneath Vicky. So Randy Weaver takes his wife's body and throws it off of their child so that the baby isn't smothered. Everyone within the house began screaming and crying, and Randy was trying to comfort the baby and rocking back and forth. And man, it is a nightmare scenario. I understand having an issue with the government, right? Or I understand having an issue with laws that you see as unjust. Randy Weaver expected violence to befall him. And while I think, at least at the beginning of this, he might have been in the state of mind that he was willing to die for it, to, you know, not to go down fighting, so to speak. But I don't think he ever imagined that his family might pay the price. But nevertheless, they did. I cannot imagine what the following hours in that cabin were like. Your son is dead in the shed, and your wife's dead on the floor. And now it's just you, your buddy you brought into this, who's now bleeding out on the kitchen floor, and your three daughters. And of course, absolutely, Randy should have no reason to expect him not showing up to court would mean the feds show up and kill his family. But in his writings and the stories Weaver would tell, he would mention how he felt a guilt, a responsibility in all of this. For everyone involved, especially the daughters who, you know, were caught up in the middle of all this, I can't imagine what that horror felt like.
A couple of points I want to mention here. For one, I got a technical error wrong with what I just said. I got the order that the bullet went through Harris and Vicky wrong. So in reality, the door was kind of bladed at like an odd angle from where Horiuchi was. So when Horiuchi fired, Vicky was actually hit first, and then it went through the door, and then it hit Harris. That explains two things. For one, it explains why Harris's wounds would be much, much worse off than Randy's, because Randy's shot went straight through him and he was pretty okay, but Harris's bullet stayed inside of him, and that's what caused the wound to become so grotesque as the story goes along. The other thing that does is provide further evidence to the idea that Horiuchi had to know that he hit Vicky, because she would have been the first thing he saw through the scope. The other thing I want to mention, just to put everything into perspective, is how now two people are dead with a guy who at the beginning of all of this wanted to negotiate. If you'll remember, all the way back when he missed his first court appearance, Randy sent down a list of negotiations that he wanted to make with the local law enforcement. And in testimonies that would come after this, right before Randy set out of the cabin and the whole scenario happened where Vicky got shot, he yelled out the door if anyone wanted to talk. Two people have been killed before a word was said.
Now, after Horiuchi took the shot, he said that the first one was a hit. He saw Randy fall down, you know, hold his shoulder and everything. But he said the second shot was a miss. According to Horiuchi, he fired the shot, didn't see anyone get hit, and they fell back into the cabin, and the standoff continued. Now, to this day, the official report is that Horiuchi did not know that Vicky Weaver had been killed. And again, they didn't even know that Sam Weaver had been killed. So at this point, the feds think that all members of the family are still alive. Now, there is some controversy around Horiuchi's statement. Some people have theorized that perhaps Horiuchi did know and either didn't want to report it or simply didn't care. That night, when he went to a local hotel to get some rest, he drew a picture of what the shot looked like on a piece of paper, and he draws a person there that supposedly the shot made contact with. Is this Harris that he's drawing the stick figure of? Is this Vicky? We don't know, but speculate how you will. Horiuchi's second shot would be one of the most criticized events of the entire Ruby Ridge incident. The Department of Justice found that while the first shot followed the rules of engagement, as absurd as they were, the second shot was completely unconstitutional because it was against a group of people who posed no immediate threat to you. They were running back for cover and running away from you, and yet he still took the shot. Horiuchi himself would get into legal trouble following the Ruby Ridge incident, but we'll talk about that when we get to it. After Horiuchi finds his shots, the FBI says, oh yeah, we're supposed to ask them to come out. Just keep in mind, up until this point, no one has said a word. There's no, come out, Weaver, you're wanted for arrest, come out with your hands up. There's no ask to surrender, none of it. They just have killed two people, and that's it. So at 6:30 p.m., they roll an APC up to like 30 feet out front of Weaver's house. And then through a megaphone, which they will not face towards the house because they're afraid of getting shot, so they're standing in the back of the APC, just like pointing it at the ground, they tell Randy that they have a warrant for his arrest, and now he should come out. The feds wait there for a while and then drive the APC back down the hill. It's also beginning at this point that the Weavers don't step out of the house again for anything. Again, they were standing inside of the house near a window and Vicky got shot. So for the rest of the siege, they crawl around on the floor underneath every window to get from one room of the house to the other. Harris is losing so much blood and in so much pain at one point in the night, he asks Randy to kill him. And Randy tells Harris that he can't do that, and if he wants that to happen, Harris has got to do it himself. Using what medical equipment they have, they try to stop the wound, but very quickly, infection begins to set in. For the rest of the standoff, Harris lies on the kitchen floor, bleeding and shivering, as his wound gets worse and worse. The next day, August 23rd, the FBI roll up once again in an APC and begin to talk on the megaphone. Now, I heard some reports say that the line I'm about to mention took place on August 23rd, but others, like the DOJ, say it was August 24th, so it was probably the 24th. But at some point during the whole, you know, tank rolling up the hill and then a negotiator, like, talking over a megaphone, one of them makes a comment to Vicky. So Randy and the family assumed that the FBI knew that Vicky had been killed, right? Because you're looking through a scope and you can see the doorway and you fire and get a perfect headshot. So surely whoever took the shot knows that he shot a woman inside of the house. And again, as we talked about, maybe he did and didn't say anything, but as far as the FBI team down at the base of the mountain goes, they had no clue. So again, on the morning of the 23rd or the 24th, whoever's talking on the megaphone, trying to start conversation, says, "Hey, what did Vicky have for breakfast this morning? Anything good?" Now, again, to the FBI, this is them trying to, you know, start a dialogue. To the Weavers, this was the most evil thing anyone could do ever. Because, again, the Weavers assume that the FBI knows Vicky's dead. So imagine someone shows up, shoots your wife in the face, and then gets on a speaker and goes, "Hey, what'd she have for breakfast this morning, huh? Would it be, I don't know, a bullet?" So, to put yourself in, like, Randy's point of view and the rest of the family during this, you've spent a long time waiting for the government to show up. And then they show up, and without announcing themselves, kill your son and your wife. And then they roll up in a tank and start making fun of your dead wife. And if that wasn't bad enough, what followed is simultaneously the dumbest and the funniest thing of the entire siege. So whoever's talking in the megaphone, which is really hard to hear, by the way, because, like, the family later said that everything was, like, echoey and it was hard to make out, you know, words or whatever. Whoever's talking in the megaphone says that now, after three people are dead, they want to negotiate. And because, you know, Randy doesn't have a telephone line or anything like that, they decide to send him one. So they get a little robot that's got, like, these dozer tracks on it and has a phone line attached to the top of it. So this little this little robot rolls out and, like, makes its way up to the front door of the Weaver's house. Randy takes one look at it and notices it has a shotgun pointed directly at the phone.
The robot was sitting right in front, right up against and right in front of the door. The robot had a claw and it had a 12-gauge shotgun that was pointed right in the door.
But once again, as far as I know, that was an oversight.
I cannot make this up. All the shooting goes down, and the FBI decides that they're going to try to talk to him, and they do it with a robot holding a gun at the thing he's supposed to put his face up to. The FBI would later say that this was an oversight. I don't believe him. I absolutely don't believe him. Who rigs up the phone robot and has it ready to go and then turns to his buddy and is like, "You took the shotgun off of that, right?" And the other guy's like, "Nah, it'll be fine." What is this guy, paranoid? It's like, you know that meme of, like, the mousetraps in the 1800s that's just a piece of cheese with a pistol aimed at it? That's literally what they tried to get Randy with. And keep in mind, this guy thinks that the FBI just wants to kill him. They don't want to negotiate. They don't want him to get arrested. They just want him to step on the porch so a sniper can kill him, right? And then they're like, "Oh no, talk to our friendly robot." And the robot has a gun. So needless to say, negotiations just don't happen. Throughout the day, the APCs begin to move to different positions around the Weaver's house. And again, the Weavers are afraid to, like, peek over the window to see what's going on for fear of being shot. So they just laid in the floor and listened to, like, tanks drive around their house all day. And at 8 p.m. on August the 23rd, they start to clear out little buildings like, you know, a chicken coop and sheds and stuff like that around the actual cabin itself. And at 8 p.m., they go to the shed that Sam's body is lying in, and they open the shed and see a dead child and go, oh, because again, they just assumed everyone was alive and that no one had been killed, despite two different gunmen absolutely should at least have known that someone was killed. And it is at this point that things start to change. An analysis is done on Sam's body, and it's seen that the shot that killed him was in the back. And that makes the FBI, specifically people like the leader of the operation, Gene Glynn, start to ask some questions. Because again, the narrative that the FBI is working off of was that the marshals stood up, identified themselves, and then Harris took a shot. And even if that were the case, what was the scenario of events that led to a 14-year-old boy being shot in the back? So on August the 24th, Gene begins to send agents to the Y to investigate what they find. Because again, the narrative provided to the FBI by the marshals was that it was a massive gunfight, they were being held down, a bunch of shots fired, but then when agents get to the Y, there's like a dozen, maybe a couple dozen casings at most. So the FBI start to ask questions of the United States Marshals. This is where a lot of the original testimonies that were later brought up in court came from. Now, at the same time this is happening, another thing that's been going on since the first day of the siege is a bunch of local people have been showing up at the base of Ruby Ridge to protest the FBI's involvement. Initially, it was a bunch of people standing around the FBI saying stuff like, if you do anything, you know, there will be witnesses, we'll attest to what you do. And once it was found out that Sam had been killed, it basically turned into the FBI holding off a mob. The FBI starts to put the pieces together and say that maybe we got a lot of this wrong. And the first change comes on August the 26th, when the FBI finally gets rid of the rules of engagement and moves it to the normal rules of engagement that you shoot someone if they're in immediate danger to someone else's life. It was also around this time that the situation at the roadblock was getting more and more hectic. Not only were hundreds of people there to protest, but remember how I said Randy had connections to Aryan Nations? Well, Aryan Nation members started to show up because in the news, the narrative was that Randy Weaver and his entire family were white supremacist. And as discussed earlier, that's at least kind of true for Randy himself, but it didn't help the public outlook of the event when the camera panned over and there was a bunch of people doing, you know, the Sig Hail and whatnot. The one device that the Weavers did have to listen to the outside world was a radio. And during the entire standoff, the radio was left on as they were hearing updates about what was happening at the bottom of the mountain. Randy began to fear that the government may storm the house in order to end the siege. But he also doesn't want to step out of the house because he assumes they're just going to shoot him. So on August the 26th, the same day that the rules of engagement were loosened, Randy asked to speak to his sister, Marnish Joy, who he heard on the radio, arrived at the checkpoint. For 2 days, the APC comes up to the mountain and his sister begins to speak with a megaphone, but because the FBI won't let her leave the APC, Randy can't really hear her and she can't really hear him. Because, you know, we wouldn't want these guys to have got an innocent woman killed in the midst of all this, right? On August the 27th, Randy hears over the radio that Bo Gritz has arrived at the bottom of Ruby Ridge. That name probably doesn't mean a lot to most of you, but in the 90s, Bo Gritz was seen as a prominent figure within military communities. Bo Gritz served in Vietnam as a Green Beret, and after the war was over, was very instrumental in getting prisoners of war and those missing in action out of Vietnam. He started a bunch of campaigns to support veterans, he would tour around to gun shows and stuff like that, and in 1988, he even ran for president. So basically, Bo Gritz was the kind of guy that Weaver would respect. So, similar to Randy's sister, the FBI drove him up next to Randy's house in the APC. Bo Gritz tries communicating through the megaphone, says, "This is stupid," and just walks out of the APC. He walks all the way onto the front porch of Weaver's cabin, knocks on the door, and asks to talk. The first time in the midst of all of this, someone just had a conversation. Bo asks Randy what's going on. Bo had been briefed on the situation as far as the FBI had known. Randy responds by saying, "I've been shot, Harris is bleeding out, and Vicky's dead." He immediately gets back in the APC and goes back down to the FBI's command post, where he tells everyone what happened. When the announcement was made that Vicky Weaver was killed by the second sniper shot, the angry crowd that was at the bottom of the mountain turned into a mob. Pressure was mounting fast for the FBI to do something, because so far it looks like they messed up a lot, and if something good doesn't come out of this, they'd be in a lot of trouble. Over the next couple days, Beau Gritz makes trips back and forth from the cabin. As you can imagine, Randy is furious and does not want to come out of the cabin as he's afraid he'll be killed. It's also worth noting, Randy and Harris were so convinced that they were going to die that they had Sarah write up their testimony of everything that went down, so that way if they die, there will be some evidence of their version of events. Beau assesses the condition of Harris, who is feverish, his wound looks awful, and he's probably got 72 hours left in him. He tells Randy that Randy can take his time and come to whatever terms he wants, but they need to get Harris to the hospital right now. Harris reluctantly agrees and is accompanied by Beau to the bottom of the hill, where he turns himself in at 6:27 p.m. on August the 30th. He's immediately transported by helicopter to a nearby hospital, and after receiving medical attention, Harris makes a full recovery. As soon as Harris surrenders, Beau Gritz, along with a friend of the Weavers named Jackie Brown, come back to the cabin to move Vicky's body. Vicky had been lying in the floor of that house for 9 days at this point. The girls had laid a sheet over her, but the area around was stained black with the carnage of the gunshot. It was a very, very brutal sight, and Randy agreed that to whatever effect can be done at this point, Vicky's body should be taken care of. As Beau and Jackie pick up her body and begin to leave, the daughters plead with him to not let her body touch the ground. When Vicky's body is brought to the bottom of the mountain, there's kind of like conflicting reports as to what the FBI's response is at that point. All of them agree the situation needs to end soon, that this has gone on for too long, but there's disagreement as to what that looks like. Many think that a use of extreme force would be necessary because it's Randy's fault that all of this has transpired. On the morning of August the 31st, Beau Gritz comes to Randy and tells him effectively that the FBI wants this to be over, they're getting hasty, and I don't know what decision they're going to make. But if you come with me right now, I promise nothing bad will happen to you, and I'll walk down there with you together. Randy, destroyed and trusting Beau at this point, takes his daughters with him, and together, the four survivors exit the cabin, which means on the morning of August 31st, the 11-day siege of Ruby Ridge finally ended. Randy was arrested and taken to receive medical treatment for his gunshot wound. I didn't really mention it earlier, but the bullet passed clean through on him, so while it hurt a lot, he didn't have a lot of damage to his body. The daughters were taken by the state and eventually sent to live with their grandparents, before after that living with their aunt and uncle, who they were closer to. Both Randy and Harris were arrested and charged for the first-degree murder of Marshall Deegan, again the marshal who was shot when all of this began. To give you an idea of how gung-ho the feds were to get a charge on somebody in the midst of this, they briefly considered charging Sarah as an adult and also implicating her in the first-degree murder. However, this idea was eventually dropped. In the media, there was a lot of misinformation that was passed around during this time. For example, it was said that Beau Gritz and Randy Weaver had served together in Vietnam, and that's why Randy went out with Beau. But that's not true. As mentioned earlier, Randy was never in the Green Berets. Actually, come to think of it, that's probably why the false narrative that he was a Green Beret gets passed around so much. Because Beau Gritz definitely was a Green Beret, so if the news kept saying they served together, that would mean Randy was also probably a Green Beret. But yeah, that just didn't happen. Both sides of the argument had extreme perspectives of why this situation began. Sides that were pro-government said that Randy had effectively lured the feds into a trap to try to kill them, while the other side said that the feds planned to assault Randy's cabin that day and kill him and the rest of his family members, which again also didn't happen. And it was a lot of he said, she said leading up to the trial. Defense attorney Jerry Spence took the case. Jerry Spence was known for being a very charismatic kind of showmanship of a lawyer. So when the trial rolled around, Spence had a very unique approach. During the entirety of the trial, Spence did not call forward a single witness. Instead, he just cross-examined everything that the FBI or the marshals or the ATF had done, and that was enough information to win over the jury. During the cross-examination of the ATF, Jerry points out that the ATF informant asked Randy if he could get the agent the short-barreled shotguns, which is entrapment. You can't, as a cop, make someone or ask someone to do a crime and then arrest them for said crime. So he gets that thrown out. On the matter of first degree murder, he goes over all the details I talked about earlier about what went down at the Y. And it's clear, comparing evidence to testimony, that the agent side of the story doesn't make a lot of sense. Not only were there holes in their narrative, like one agent said the shots started at this moment, and another one said the shots actually started at this moment, but they had changed their account so many times that it was easy to poke holes in. He eventually ruled that every action that Randy Weaver, as well as Harris, and the rest of the Weaver family took was reasonable for someone who was randomly attacked by extreme force with no chance to surrender. The trial began on April the 13th of 1993. Randy had been charged with 10 different charges, from the first degree murder and the short-barreled shotguns I already mentioned, to things like conspiracy.
Is that a mosquito?
To things like conspiracy and resisting arrest and blah, blah, blah. When the trial ended in June of 1993, Randy had been acquitted for every single charge except the original failure to appear in court. For that charge, Randy was sentenced to 18 months in jail and a $10,000 fine. However, he was credited with time served since he had been in jail for over a year already awaiting trial. And Randy Weaver was released in December of 1993. In the meantime, Harris's shot against Marshall Deegan was ruled as justified and he was let go with full acquittal. 5 years later, when a new local prosecutor came to Boundary County, he tried to prosecute Harris over this shooting again. I guess that the prosecutor was just really mad that he got away with it, but obviously that couldn't go through because double jeopardy. The same FBI hostage rescue team that was at Ruby Ridge would be deployed to another little location called Waco, Texas that same year. In response to this, the Department of Justice had a massive crackdown on FBI operations. They assembled something called the Ruby Ridge Task Force that compiled a 542-page report of the HRT's actions both at Ruby Ridge and Waco. The main things they criticized about Ruby Ridge was the rules of engagement and Horiuchi's second shot. Largely because of the events of Ruby Ridge, rules of engagement have now, for the most part, been standardized across the board. Again, if someone's life isn't in immediate danger, you can't take someone else's. The other thing that they were super critical of, as mentioned, is there was no dialogue or conversation ever opened with Randy before they started shooting. On top of that, more details came to light. Like, after the first time the marshals were told by Randy to leave the property, the marshals were then told by their home office to not try to talk to him again, and instead just go through his legal team. You know, the legal team Randy hates and doesn't trust, and also doesn't talk to. In 1997, it came out that the chief of the Violent Crimes Division of the FBI had purposefully hidden a report that was critical of the agents at Ruby Ridge. Meaning that internally, as the event was going on, the FBI was trying to hide as much evidence as they can. This was noted by both the judge and defense attorney during Randy's trial. As information they tried to get, which was evidence concerning crime scene photos at the Y, to reports of what was said between FBI agents to each other, were either missing or became doctored. Lon Horiuchi has an individual investigation concerning his second shot, to which the feds say they're not going to pursue a case. Later on, the state of Idaho would try to hold a trial for Horiuchi. The trial begins, and immediately the federal government says, since he's a federal agent, this is their case. Idaho passes off the case to the feds, and the feds immediately drop the case. But then a circuit county judge says that the feds need to reopen the case, so they reopen it, and then it gets transferred to another division that gets dropped again, then somehow it goes back to Idaho, and after like three or four flips of Horiuchi being on trial, then not on trial, eventually, when Idaho gets a hold of it, the prosecutor drops the case, saying that it's effectively unwinnable because the government will just keep having them jump through hoops for years and years before they admit any fault. And keep in mind, Horiuchi was also one of the snipers who was stationed at Waco. Which, if you want to know how I feel about that whole shebang, link in the description. The only real punishment that came out of any of this was the HRT commander, Richard Rogers, was demoted temporarily. But then, like, he continued to politic his way up the ranks. And again, he was also at Waco. In August of 1995, the Weaver family filed a civil lawsuit against the government for the wrongful death of Sam and Vicki Weaver. During the civil lawsuit, for the first time, Randy admitted some level of fault in what happened, saying that if he had behaved differently, this probably wouldn't have had to have happened. But, and I agree rightfully so, American citizens shouldn't have to worry about the government killing family members over a crime, much less a nonviolent crime. The Weavers initially sued for $200 million, and the government, not wanting to make this a whole public publicity thing, public publicity, what am I saying? Not wanting it to be a very public case, they settle outside of court, to which Randy is awarded $100,000, and the three oldest daughters are awarded $1 million each, totaling up to $3.1 million. From here, things begin to die down. In 1998, Randy published his own book titled The Federal Siege at Ruby Ridge, in our own words, which is where a lot of his details of what happened during the siege came to be. Sarah Weaver would also publish her own book over the events, as well as give several interviews and podcast appearances to tell her side of the story. I will say I really like Sarah Weaver. In all the appearances and interviews I've watched of her, she has, for one, a pleasant demeanor, but also she has found a peace about everything that's happened. She forgives the federal government and the agents that were responsible. She has found a more, I'll say, charitable version of Christianity, and doesn't hold hate in her heart for anything that happened, and instead doesn't want people to see Ruby Ridge as a reason to be violent, to do more evil actions, and instead learn from it so we can be better in the future. Now, for as much as it seems Sarah has progressed since the events of Ruby Ridge, Randy did the opposite. It seems, and again, I never knew the guy, but from interviews and testimonies from those around him and things like that, it seems he became very bitter after the events that happened. And while it's perfectly rational to be angry over the events that happened, it seems that he just decided to live in it. To give you an idea of how much he changed, in 2007, there was this protest against taxes that was getting violent and police were showing up. Randy, like in between Ruby Ridge and then, would go to a lot of different like militia camps or places where there was some kind of government standoff. He would go and like help protest. So he was at this tax protest, and someone in the crowd remarked that you might be killed, and Randy said that he wants to die because he's an atheist and just wants to see what happens, which is a far, far cry from the people who wrote letters to the government saying the end times were coming and talked about, you know, the judgment of God, to now just say he's an atheist and doesn't care. Again, I don't really, it's hard to have sympathy for Randy given his, I guess, stubbornness, so to speak, that kicked a lot of this off, as well as his own, you know, personal hatreds and whatnot. But it's, I guess it's tragic to see anyone go to waste, right?
Last couple things I want to stop in to mention is, for one, the media's response to Ruby Ridge was as could be expected. Similar to how, as the siege was going on, it was just framed as justified actions on behalf of the government, and a bunch of crazy, you know, radical extremists showed up to protest. So people who oppose that narrative used that as fuel to further oppose media, and things kept going the way they always do. Another massive effect of Ruby Ridge, and its most tragic one, is that of the Oklahoma City bombing. Timothy McVeigh, who carried out the Oklahoma City bombing, was a very loud proponent against the government's actions at Ruby Ridge. So much so that during the trials of Lon Horiuchi, or what little trial existed, he would sit outside handing out bumper stickers with Lon Horiuchi's home address. And of course, when McVeigh would eventually commit the attacks of the Oklahoma City bombing, he cited Waco and Ruby Ridge as his reasons for doing so. Again, one senseless tragedy usually begets another.
Ruby Ridge has made its way into so many different aspects of pop culture. In 1996, there was a miniseries about the events of Ruby Ridge, starring Jack Quaid and Kirsten Dunst. In 1999, Peter Rowan made a song called The Ballad of Ruby Ridge. And a lot of different stories, and especially stories involving government overreach, take inspiration from the events of the Ruby Ridge siege. As mentioned, a lot of books were written regarding the events. One of the more popular ones was by a reporter named Jess Walter. The book was titled Every Knee Shall Bow, which the title of that book was actually inspired by one of the signs seen at the Weavers' compound. Years later, Harris would sue the government for damages, and after the government responded that someone who killed a federal agent will never receive money from them, Harris received $380,000. On May the 11th of 2022, Randy Weaver passed away at the age of 74 due to natural causes. And according to those around him, it seems that even at the end of his life, Randy never found peace. And with that, we have the end of the Ruby Ridge Siege. So, what is there to say about it? Similar to most of these situations involving some kind of government standoff, like Waco, for example, I think it's once again a symptom of hubris. Maybe if at some point he had stepped out, or maybe if during the initial, you know, time that he was wanted for a failure to appear in court, he just walked off the mountain. Maybe all of this could have been avoided. At the same time, he shouldn't have to worry that his wife and son will be shot if he doesn't go to jail. On the government side, just as what happens with these government issues over and over again, a failure to admit fault leads to more faults. If the ATF would have told the marshals that Randy wasn't as expressly violent as they made him out to be, maybe the marshals wouldn't have responded with such powerful force. And then maybe if when the marshals passed it off to the FBI, they gave a more accurate accounting of events instead of a series of events that made them look better, the FBI wouldn't have established a kill on sight order. Randy is not where my anger lies in this story. I talk about all kinds of different people on this channel. I talk about serial killers, I talk about cult leaders, I talk about cannibals sometimes. I talk about all kinds of evil people, and there are a lot of evil people out there. The reason I don't worry about them, and 99% of the population doesn't go around worrying about them every day, is because there are barriers and systems in place to protect the good from the bad. Randy Weaver was a dude who lived in Idaho and allied himself with some very wicked people. Those are a dime a dozen. I am not distraught and hurt over Randy Weaver's personal morality or decisions. I am brokenhearted over my government's bad decisions. If they're to be believed and their purpose is to keep us safe and keep our best interest in mind, then what does that look like when anytime a situation goes bad, they refuse to de-escalate and continue to say it wasn't their fault? If there is no culpability, if there's no admittance to something going wrong, then therefore everything that happened in your mind is the way it's supposed to go. So if that's how you want to be treated, that's how you'll be treated. If they're so desperate to earn the reputation as a hammer willing to dispel any dissent that comes their way, then cool, they've earned it. There should be a sacrosanctity to the office of our leaders and our protectors. They should not be the lowest common denominator of a population. Both sides of this conflict kept beating their chest over and over to get the other one to back down. And eventually, the federal government did that by killing a young boy and his mother. So, congrats, you win, I guess. Ruby Ridge does not need to have a perfect family who never did anything wrong to be an example of government overreach, because as it stands, it is an example of government overreach. The reason I get so fired up about Ruby Ridge, and the reason most people do, isn't because I just hate federal agents or anything. As a matter of fact, most federal agents I've talked to agreed that both Ruby Ridge and Waco were tragedies that never should have happened, but that's not the official report, is it? The official report is that they dispelled the threat. Mission accomplished. If they're to be looked at as anything other than tyrants, then they'd have to be better. And the reason that I get so upset about it is because I want us to be better. I want us to mean something. And Ruby Ridge is an important story to remember so that, hopefully, we don't make the same mistakes again. But of course, I'm just a YouTuber. I just make funny, goofy videos, so what do I know? But now, hopefully, you know more now about Ruby Ridge than you did when you started this video. And if you did, that's great, and I greatly appreciate it, and I just want to say thank you for watching. Really though, thank you all so much for watching. It really does mean the world. Ruby Ridge is something that I've wanted to cover for a really long time, ever since the Waco video, and I've always just kind of kept putting it off, but I just came back around to the story, figured now would be a good time, so hopefully you all enjoyed. I really appreciate it. It was weird for me, because I went into it under the, I guess, the interpretation most people have of, like, Randy was a completely innocent guy, you know, like the government just preyed on one random guy who made a couple short shotguns, right? But it was more than that, which, again, doesn't alleviate the government's actions, but it does paint almost a more tragic picture of the fault on both sides. Anyway, you all heard the video. I hope you enjoyed it. I do want to say, I apologize for the lack of uploads lately. With everything going on in my life, getting married to starting the two new podcasts and stuff, I kind of needed to slow down here on the main channel for a while just while I got everything in order. But now that I have everything in order, I can definitively say that things are going great. I'm so excited to just full bore pick up the pace with the content again. I've got a lot of great ideas. I say great ideas in my head, they're great ideas. We'll see how they turn out. But hopefully you all enjoy. Thank you for sticking around, and thank you for bearing with me through the lack of uploads. Again, as always, thank you so much for the support that you all have shown on both Creepcast and the Red Thread. It means the world. A special plug for the Red Thread, because recently we covered Waco on there. So there's more Waco content if you're interested in the sequel, I guess, to Ruby Ridge. I believe that should do it. Like I said, more content on the way. Check out the merch, as mentioned, and the beanie that's over there. Check it out in the description. Get it while you can. Available for a very limited amount of time, then it's gone forever. And I believe that should do it for now. If I can't think of anything else, no. Some links to some of the DOJ reports and stuff like that will be in the description if you're interested in further reading, but you probably knew that at this point. And I believe that should do it for now. But I just want to say, thank you for watching. I hope that you enjoyed, and I will see you in the next one. Bye!